One common solution or division of labor that couples unconsciously arrange is that the woman will express the wish for togetherness, the man the wish for separateness. We will be taking a closer look at this dance between the pursuing female and the distancing male in Chapter 3. If we are chronically angry or bitter in a particular relationship, that may be a message to clarify and strengthen the I a bit more. We must re-examine our own selves with a view toward discovering what we think, feel, and want, and what we need to do differently in our lives. The more we carve out a clear and separate I, the more we can experience and enjoy both intimacy and aloneness. Our intimacy need not be sameness or oneness or loss of self. Our aloneness and separateness need not be distance and isolation. Why is strengthening the I such a difficult task? There are many factors, but if we keep a narrow focus on the here and now, Barbara's situation illustrates how scary it can be to move to a higher level of clarity and assertiveness. Barbara could not give up her old ways and try out some new ones without experiencing an anxiety-arousing feeling of separateness and without making waves in her marriage. Since this is true in all relationships, let's take a closer look. Clarity and the fear of loss. If Barbara had a clearer I to begin with, she would not define her problem as, "My husband won't let me go to the workshop." Instead, she might say something like the following to herself. "My problem is this. If I cancel the workshop, I will feel bitter and resentful. If I go to the workshop, my husband will feel bitter and resentful. Which do I choose?" After some thought, she might decide that the workshop was not that important, or that the timing just wasn't right for her to make waves in the marriage. Or she might conclude that the workshop was a non-negotiable issue on which she would not compromise. In this case, she might think about how to present her decision to her husband in a way that would minimize the power struggle. Or she might simply inform him that she was going. Later, when things were calm, she might initiate a discussion about decision-making in the marriage and explain that while she was interested in his opinions, she was ultimately in charge of making her own decisions. What stopped Barbara from achieving this kind of clarity? Why would any of us end up as chronic fighters and complainers rather than identify our problems and choices and clarify our position? No, women do not gain a secret masochistic gratification from being in the victimized, one-down position. Quite to the contrary, the woman who sits at the bottom of a seesaw marriage accumulates a great amount of rage, which is in direct proportion to the degree of her submission and sacrifice. The dilemma is that we may unconsciously be convinced that our important relationships can survive only if we continue to remain one down. To do better, to become clearer, to act stronger, to be more separate, to take action on our own behalf, may be unconsciously equated with a destructive act that will diminish and threaten our partner, who might then retaliate or leave. Sometimes, to develop a stronger I is to come to terms with our deep-seated wish to leave an unsatisfactory marriage, and this possibility may be no less frightening than the fear of being left. Perhaps Barbara is not ready to face the risk of putting her husband and herself to the test of whether change is possible. She may already be convinced that the relationship cannot tolerate much change. She may be caught between a rock and a hard place. Neither is she ready to say to herself, "I am choosing to stay in this unhappy marriage with a man who is not going to change." Nor can she clarify a bottom line and say, "If these things do not change, I will leave." Or perhaps Barbara is not yet ready to face anxiety or the funny depression that often hits us when we take a clearer and more separate stance in a meaningful relationship. Fighting and blaming is sometimes a way both to protest and to protect the status quo, when we are not quite ready to make a move in one direction or another. Counter moves and change back reactions. I do not wish to convey the bleak impression that we must stay put on the bottom of the seesaw lest our partner, as well as our relationship, come tumbling down. In some cases, this may happen as a consequence of our change and growth, but more frequently, and depending on how we proceed, the other person will grow along with us, and our emotional ties will ultimately be strengthened. We can learn to strengthen our own selves in a way that will maximize the chances that we will enhance rather than threaten our relationships. Making a change, however, never occurs easily and smoothly. We meet with a countermove or change back reaction from the other person whenever we begin to give up the old ways of silence, vagueness, or ineffective fighting and begin to make clear statements about the needs, wants, beliefs, and priorities of the self. In fact, Murray Bowen, the originator of Bowen family systems theory, emphasizes the fact that in all families, there is a powerful opposition to one member defining a more independent self. According to Bowen, the opposition invariably goes in successive steps. 1. You are wrong, with volumes of reasons to support this. 2. Change back and we will accept you again. 3. If you don't change back, these are the consequences, which are then listed. What are some common countermoves? We may be accused of coldness, disloyalty, selfishness, or disregard for others. How could you upset your mother by saying that to her? We may receive verbal or nonverbal threats that the other person will withdraw or terminate the relationship. We can't be close if you feel that way. How can we have a relationship if you really mean that? Countermoves take any number of forms. For example, a person may have an asthma attack or even a stroke. Countermoves are the other person's unconscious attempt to restore a relationship to its prior balance or equilibrium. When anxiety about separateness and change gets too high. Other people do not make countermoves simply because they are dominating, controlling, or chauvinistic. They may or may not be these things, but that is almost beside the point. Countermoves are an expression of anxiety, as well as of closeness and attachment. Our job is to keep clear about our own position in the face of a countermove, not to prevent it from happening or to tell the other person that he or she should not be reacting that way. Most of us want the impossible. We want to control not only our own decisions and choices, but also the other person's reactions to them. We not only want to make a change, we want the other person to like the change that we make. We want to move ahead to a higher level of assertiveness and clarity, and then receive praise and reinforcement from those very people who have chosen us for our old familiar ways. Countermoves aside, our own resistance to change is just as formidable a force. Barbara's position in her marriage, for example, may have roots in patterns that go back for many generations. Barbara's mother and other women relatives who came before her may have assumed a de-selfed position in marriage, or may have paired up with de-selfed husbands. There may not be a tradition in Barbara's family for marriages in which both partners can be clear and competent in making decisions about their own lives and negotiating differences. All of us are deeply affected by the patterns and traditions of past generations, even if, and especially if, we are not consciously aware of them. Like many women, Barbara may feel guilty if she strives to have for herself what her own mother could not. Deep in her unconscious mind, Barbara may view her attempt at self-assertion as an act of disloyalty, a betrayal not only of her husband, but also of generations of women in her family. If this is the case, she will unconsciously resist the changes that she seeks. To complicate matters further, unresolved issues from our past inevitably surface in our current relationships. If Barbara is stuck in a pattern of chronic marital fighting and blaming, That may be a sign that she has not negotiated her separateness and independence within her first family, and that she needs to do some work here. See Chapter 4. How well is Barbara able to take a firm position on important issues with members of her first family? Is she able to make clear and direct statements of her own thoughts and feelings? Is she able to be who she is and not what other family members want or expect her to be, and allow others to do the same? If Barbara is having difficulty staying in emotional contact with living members of her first family and defining a clear and separate I within this context, she may have difficulty doing so in her marriage. As a psychotherapist, I often help women to clarify and to change their relationships with siblings, parents, and grandparents so that underground family conflicts and patterns will not be replayed, nor buried anger and anxieties pop up in another close relationship, making for a painful degree of reactivity to others. Where are we? Barbara's telephone call provided us with an excellent example of ineffective fighting that ensures non-change, because she did two things that we all do when we are stuck and spinning our wheels. First, she fought about a false issue. Second, she put her energy into trying to change the other person. Pseudo-issues. Barbara and her husband probably put a great deal of energy into fighting about the value of my workshop, which is, like most things in life, a matter of personal opinion. More to the point, it's a pseudo-issue. It has nothing to do with Barbara's real problem, which concerns her struggle between her wish to make responsible decisions for her own life and her wish to preserve togetherness in her marriage and protect the status quo. All couples fight over pseudo-issues some of the time, and often with great intensity. I will never forget the very first couple I saw in marital therapy. There in my office they sat, quarreling bitterly over whether they would eat their dinner that evening at McDonald's or Long John Silver's. Each of these intelligent people put forth the most compelling arguments regarding the relative merits of hamburger or fish, and neither would give an inch. Being new at marital therapy, I was not quite certain how to be helpful to this couple. But I did know one thing for sure. The impassioned argument I was witnessing between two people who were obviously in a great deal of pain had nothing to do with the respective value of burgers and fish. Identifying the real issues is no easy matter. It is particularly difficult among family members, because when two adults have a conflict, they often bring in a third party, perhaps a child or an in-law, to form a triangle, which then makes it even harder for the two people involved to identify and work out their problems. For example, a wife says to her husband, "I am terribly angry about the way you ignore our son. I feel like he's growing up without a father." The real issue not addressed is, "I feel ignored, and I am angry that you do not spend more time with me." A husband says to his wife, who is considering a new job, "The children need you at home. I support your working, but I don't like to see the kids and the household neglected." The real issue not addressed is, "I'm scared and worried about your making this change. I'm not sure how your career will affect our relationship, and your enthusiasm about this new work is putting me in touch with my dissatisfaction with my own job." A wife says to her husband, "Your mother is driving me crazy. She's intrusive and controlling, and she treats you like you're her husband and little boy all wrapped up in one." The real issue not addressed is, "I wish you could be more assertive with your mother and set some limits. Sometimes I wonder whether your primary commitment is to me or to her." When we learn about triangles, Chapter 8, we'll see that it is difficult to sort out not only what we are angry about, but also whom we are angry at. Trying to change him. Barbara, like most of us, was putting her anger energy into trying to change the other person. She was trying to change her husband's thoughts and feelings about the workshop and his reactions to her going. She wanted him to approve of the workshop, and she wanted him to want her to go. In short, she wanted him to think and feel about the workshop as she did. Of course, most of us secretly believe that we have the corner on the truth, and that this would be a much better world if everyone else believed and reacted exactly as we do. But one of the hallmarks of emotional maturity is to recognize the validity of multiple realities, and to understand that people think, feel, and react differently. Often we behave as if closeness means sameness. Married couples and family members are especially prone to behave as if there is one reality that should be agreed upon by all. It's extremely difficult to learn, with our hearts as well as our heads, that we have a right to everything we think and feel, and so does everyone else. It is our job to state our thoughts and feelings clearly, and to make responsible decisions that are congruent with our values and beliefs. It is not our job to make another person think and feel the way we do, or the way we want them to. If we try, we can end up in a relationship in which a lot of personal pain and emotional intensity are being expended, and nothing is changing. There is nothing wrong with wanting to change someone else. The problem is that it usually doesn't work. No matter how skilled we become in dealing with our anger, we cannot ensure that another person will do what we want him or her to, or see things our way, nor are we guaranteed that justice will prevail. We are able to move away from ineffective fighting only when we give up the fantasy that we can change or control another person. It's only then that we can reclaim the power that is truly ours, the power to change our own selves and take a new and different action on our own behalf. In the chapters that follow, we will learn how to put the lessons from Barbara's phone call into practice. What are these seemingly simple lessons? First, letting it all hang out may not be helpful, because venting anger may protect rather than challenge the old rules and patterns in a relationship. Second, the only person we can change and control is our own self. Third, changing our own self can feel so threatening and difficult that it's often easier to continue an old pattern of silent withdrawal or ineffective fighting and blaming. And finally, de-selfing is at the heart of our most serious anger problems. Chapter 3. Circular Dances in Couples. When getting angry is getting nowhere. 6 months after the birth of my first son, I was vacationing with my family in Berkeley, California. Browsing through a second-hand bookstore, I came upon a volume by a foremost expert in child development. My heart sank slightly as I noted that my baby was not doing the things that the book said were appropriate for his age. My God, I thought to myself, my child is slow. I flashed back on the complications that had characterized my pregnancy, and I froze. Was something wrong with my baby? When I saw my husband, Steve, later in the day, I anxiously told him my fears. He responded with uncharacteristic insensitivity. "Forget it," he said matter-of-factly. "Babies develop at different rates. He's fine." His response, which I heard as an attempt to silence me, only upset me further. I reacted by trying to prove my point. I told him in detail what the book said, and I reminded him of the problems I had experienced throughout the pregnancy. He accused me of exaggerating the problem and of worrying excessively. Nothing was wrong. I accused him of denying and minimizing the problem. Something might be wrong. He reminded me coldly that my mother was a worrier, and that clearly I was following in her footsteps. I reminded him angrily that worrying was not permitted in his family, since problems were not to be noticed. And then followed more of the same. We repeated this same fight, in its same form, countless times over the next 6 months, as our son continued even more conspicuously not to do what the book said he should be doing. The psychologist who tested him at 9 months, at my initiation, said that he was in fact quite slow in certain areas, but that it was too early to know what this meant. She suggested that we wait a while and then consult with a pediatric neurologist if we were still concerned. Steve and I became even more rigidly polarized in our fights, and we fought with increasing frequency. Like robots, we took the same repetitive positions, and the sequence unfolded as neatly as clockwork. The more I expressed worry and concern, the more Steve distanced and minimized. The more he distanced and minimized, the more I exaggerated my position. This sequence would escalate until it finally became intolerable, at which point each of us would angrily point the finger at the other for starting it. We were stuck. Our years of psychological training and intellectual sophistication went down the drain. It was clear enough that what each of us was doing only provoked a more vehement stance in the other. Yet somehow, neither Steve nor I was able to do something different ourselves. "Your baby is fine," a top pediatric neurologist in Kansas City reported blandly. "Our son was almost a year old. He has an atypical developmental pattern. There are certain babies who don't do much of anything until they walk. Sure enough, our son began to walk, right on schedule, no less, without having crawled, scooted, or in any way moved about preceding this. And so ended our chronic, repetitive fights. Later we were able to recognize the unconscious benefits we got by maintaining these fights. Fighting with each other helped both of us to worry a little less about our son, and deflected our attention from other concerns we had about becoming new parents. But what was most impressive at the time was how irrevocably stuck we were. We both behaved as if there was only one right way to respond to a stressful situation in the family, and we engaged in a dance in which we were trying to get the other person to change steps while we would not change our own. The outcome was that nothing changed at all. Getting stuck, getting unstuck. How do couples get stuck? The inability to express anger is not always at the heart of the problem. Many women, like myself, get angry with ease and have no difficulty showing it. Instead, the problem is that getting angry is getting nowhere, or even making things worse. If what we're doing with our anger is not achieving the desired result, it would seem logical to try something different. In my case, I could have changed my behavior with Steve in a number of ways. Surely it was clear to me that my anxious expressions of worry only provoked his denial, which then provoked more worry on my part. For example, I might have taken my worry to a good friend for several weeks and stopped expressing it to Steve. Perhaps then Steve would have had the opportunity to experience his own worry. Or I might have approached Steve at a time when we were close and shared with him that I was worrying a lot about our baby and that I hoped for his help and support as I struggled with this. Such an approach would have been quite different from my usual behavior, which involved speaking out at the very height of my anxiety and then implying that Steve was at fault for not reacting the same way as I. Steve, too, might easily have broken the pattern of our fights by doing something different himself. For example, he might have initiated a talk in which he expressed concern for our son. We all recognize intellectually that repeating our ineffective efforts achieves nothing and can even make things worse. Yet, oddly enough, most of us continue to do more of the same, especially under stress. For example, a wife who lectures her husband about his failure to stay on his diet increases the intensity or frequency of her lectures when he overeats. A woman whose lover becomes cooler when she angrily presses him to express feelings presses on even harder. Her problem being not that she is unable to get angry, but that she's doing something with her anger that isn't working, and yet keeps doing it. Even rats in a maze learn to vary their behavior if they keep hitting a dead end. Why in the world, then, do we behave less intelligently than laboratory animals? The answer by now may be obvious. Repeating the same old fights protects us from the anxieties we are bound to experience when we make a change. Ineffective fighting allows us to stop the clock when our efforts to achieve greater clarity become too threatening. Sometimes staying stuck is what we need to do until the time comes when we are confident that it is safe to get unstuck. Sometimes, however, even when we are ready to risk change, we still keep participating in the same old familiar fights that go nowhere. Human nature is such that when we are angry, we tend to become so emotionally reactive to what the other person is doing to us that we lose our ability to observe our own part in the interaction. Self-observation is not at all the same as self-blame, at which some women are experts. Rather, self-observation is the process of seeing the interaction of ourselves and others and recognizing that the ways other people behave with us has something to do with the way we behave with them. We cannot make another person be different, but when we do something different ourselves, the old dance can no longer continue as usual. The story of Sandra and Larry, a couple who sought my help, is a story about getting unstuck. While the content of their struggles may or may not hit home, the form of the dance they do together is almost universal. For this couple, like many, was caught in a circular dance in which the behavior of each served to maintain and provoke that of the other. Once we are part of an established twosome, married or unmarried, lesbian or straight, we may easily become caught in such a dance. When this happens, the more each person tries to change things, the more things stay the same. Sandra and Larry. "Well, how do each of you see the problem in your marriage?" I inquired. It was my first meeting with Sandra and Larry, who had requested marital therapy at Sandra's initiative. My eyes fell first on Larry and then on Sandra, who quickly picked up the invitation to speak. She turned her body in my direction and cupped her hands against her face. Like blinders, they blocked Larry from her view. With unveiled anger in her voice, Sandra listed her complaints. It was evident that she had told her story before. It was also evident that she thought the problem was her husband. "First of all, he's a workaholic," she began. "He neglects the kids and me. I don't even think he knows how to relate to us anymore. He's a stranger in his own family." Sandra paused for a moment, drew a deep breath, and continued. "He acts like he expects me to run the house and deal with the kids all by myself. And then when something goes wrong, he tells me I'm crazy to be reacting so emotionally. He's not available, and he never expresses his feelings about things that should worry him." When Larry comes home, and you're upset about something at home, how do you ask for his support and help? I asked. "I tell him that I'm really upset, that I'm worried about our money situation, and that Jeff is sick, and that I had to miss my class, and that I'm going nuts with the baby today. But he just looks at me and criticizes me that the dinner isn't ready, or tells me that I'm overreacting. He always says, 'Why do you get so damn emotional about everything?' He makes me want to scream." Sandra fell silent, and Larry said nothing. After several minutes, Sandra continued, her anger now laced with tears. "I'm tired of being at the bottom of his list of priorities. He hardly ever takes the initiative to relate to me, and he neglects the kids, too. And then when he does decide that he wants to be a father, he just takes over like he's the only one in charge." "For example?" I asked. "For example, he goes out and buys Lori, our oldest daughter, this expensive dressing table that she's had her eye on, and he doesn't even consult me. He just tells me after the fact." Sandra is now glaring at Larry, who refuses to meet her eye. "When Larry does something that you disapprove of, like the dressing table incident, how do you let him know?" "It's impossible," Sandra said emphatically. "It's simply impossible." "What is impossible?" I persisted. "Talking to him, confronting him. He doesn't talk about feelings. He doesn't know how to discuss things. He just doesn't respond. He clams up and wants to be left alone. He doesn't even know how to fight. Either he talks in this super logical manner, or he refuses to talk at all. He'd rather read a book or turn on the television." "Okay," I said. "I think I understand how you see the problem." It was Larry's turn now. "How do you define the problem in your marriage, Larry?" Larry proceeded to speak in a controlled and deliberate voice that almost masked the fact that he was as angry as his wife. "Sandra isn't supportive enough. She doesn't give enough, and she's always on my back. I think that's the main problem. Larry fell silent, as if he was finished for the day. In what ways does Sandra fail to support you or give to you? Can you share a specific example? Well, it's hard to say. She cuts me down a lot, for one thing. Or I walk in the door at 6 o'clock, and I'm tired and wanting some peace and quiet, and she just rattles on about the kids' problems or her problems, or she just complains about one thing or another. Or if I sit down to relax for 5 minutes, she's on my back to discuss some earth-shaking matter, like the garbage disposal is broken. Larry was angry, but he managed to sound as if he was discussing the Dow Jones average. "Are you saying that you need some space?" I asked. "Not exactly," replied Larry. "I'm saying that Sandra is very overreactive. She's very over-emotional. She creates problems where they don't even exist. Everything is a major case. And yes, I suppose I am saying that I need more space." "What about the kids? Do you..." I had not finished my question when Larry interrupted. "Sandra is a very over-involved mother," he explained carefully, as if he were describing a patient at a clinical conference. "She worries excessively about the children. She inherited it from her mother. And if you could meet her mother, you would understand." "Do you worry about the kids?" I inquired. "Only when there's something to worry about. For Sandra, it seems to be a full-time job." Although one would not have guessed it from this first session, Sandra and Larry were deeply committed to each other. At our initial meeting, however, they appeared to share only one thing in common: blaming. Like many couples, each spouse saw the locus of his or her marital difficulties as existing entirely within the other person. And each had the same unstated goal for marital therapy, that the other would be fixed up and straightened out. Let's take a closer look at the details of Sandra and Larry's story, for there is much to be learned. Though couples differ markedly in how they present themselves, the ways in which they get stuck are very much the same. "He just doesn't respond. She's very over-emotional." Sound familiar? Sandra and Larry's central complaints about each other will ring a bell for many couples. His unfeelingness, unavailability, and distance is a major source of her anger. "My husband withdraws from confrontation and cannot share his real feelings. My husband is like a machine. My husband refuses to talk about things. My husband is more invested in his work than in his family." And it is no coincidence that men have a reciprocal complaint. "My wife is much too reactive. She gets irrational much too easily. I wish that she would back off and stop nagging and bitching. My wife wants to talk everything to death." As typically happens, the very qualities that each partner complains of in the other are those that attracted them to each other to begin with. Sandra, for example, had been drawn to Larry's orderly, even-keel temperament, just as he had admired her capacity to be emotional and spontaneous. Her reactive, feeling-oriented approach to the world balanced his distant, logical reserve, and vice versa. Opposites attract, right? Opposites do attract, but they do not always live happily ever after. On the one hand, it is reassuring to live with someone who will express parts of one's own self that one is afraid to acknowledge. Yet the arrangement has its inevitable costs. The woman who is expressing feelings not only for herself but also for her husband will indeed end up behaving hysterically and irrationally. The man who relies on his wife to do the feeling work for him will increasingly lose touch with this important part of himself. And when the time comes that he needs to draw upon his emotional resources, he may find that nobody's at home. In the majority of couples, men sit on the bottom of the seesaw when it comes to emotional competence. We all know about the man who can tie good knots on packages and fix things that break, yet fails to notice that his wife is depressed. He may have little emotional relatedness to his own family, and lack even one close friend with whom honest self-disclosure takes place. This is the masculinity that our society breeds, the male who feels at home in the world of things and abstract ideas, but who has little empathic connection to others, little attunement to his own internal world, and little willingness or capacity to hang in when a relationship becomes conflicted and stressful. In the traditional division of labor, men are encouraged to develop one kind of intelligence, but they fall short of another that is equally important. The majority underfunction in the realm of emotional competence, and their underfunctioning is closely related to women's overfunctioning in this area. It is not by accident that the hysterical, over-emotional female ends up under the same roof as the unemotional, distant male. The marital seesaw is hard to balance. When couples do try to balance it, especially under stress, their solutions often exacerbate the problem. The emotional, feeling-oriented wife, who gets on her husband's back to open up and express feelings, will find that he becomes cooler and even less available. The cool, intellectual husband, who tries calmly to use logic to quiet his over-emotional wife, will find that she becomes even more agitated. True to stereotype, each partner continues to do the same old thing while trying to change the other. The solution for righting the balance becomes the problem. Doing the feeling work for Larry. Sandra had long been furious at Larry's lack of reactivity without realizing her own part in the circular dance. She failed to recognize that she was so skilled and comfortable in expressing feelings that she was doing the job for the two of them, thus protecting her husband from feeling what he would otherwise feel. Doing the feeling work, like cleaning up, has long been defined as woman's work, and lots of women are good at it. As with cleaning up, men will not begin to do their share until women no longer do it for them. Although it was not her conscious intent, Sandra helped Larry to maintain his under-emotional stance by expressing more than her share of emotionality. The unconscious contract for this couple was that Sandra would be the emotional reactor and Larry the rational planner. And so, Sandra reacted for Larry. She did so in response not only to family stresses that concerned them both, but also to problems that were really Larry's to struggle with. Here are two examples of how Sandra protected Larry by doing the feeling work for him. An injustice on the job. One evening, when Larry returned from work, he told Sandra that a co-worker had gotten credit for an idea that was originally his. As he began to outline the details of the incident, Sandra became upset and expressed her strong anger at the injustice. As her emotional involvement in the incident increased, she noticed that Larry was becoming cooler and more removed. "Aren't you upset about this?" she demanded. "It's your life, you know. Don't you have any feelings about it?" Of course Larry had feelings about it. It was his career, and the injustice had been done to him. However, his style of reacting, as well as his tempo and timing, was very different from his wife's. Also, Larry was using Sandra to react for him. Her quick outburst actually took him off the hook. He did not have to feel upset about the incident because she was doing all the work. The more emotion Sandra displayed, the less Larry felt within himself. Sandra was consciously angry and frustrated at Larry's apparent lack of feelings about the incident, yet she was unconsciously helping him to maintain his strong, cool, masculine position. By criticizing him for not showing feelings and demonstrating the appropriate degree of distress, she was applying a solution that only reinforced the very problem she complained of. Sandra could not make Larry react differently. However, she could do something different herself. When Sandra stopped doing the feeling work for Larry, the circular dance was broken. It was not easy for Sandra to change her behavior, but eventually she did make an important shift. Sometime later, when Larry shared a crisis at work, Sandra listened calmly and quietly. She did not express feelings that appropriately belonged to Larry, nor did she offer solutions to a problem that was not hers. Given sufficient time and space around him, Larry did indeed begin to react to his own problem and struggle with his own dilemma. In fact, he became depressed. But while this was the very reaction Sandra had overtly sought and wished for, that cool bastard doesn't react to anything, she was uncomfortable seeing her husband vulnerable and struggling. She realized, to her surprise, that part of her wanted Larry to maintain the role of the cool, strong, unruffled partner. A problem with Larry's parents. Sandra also protected Larry from recognizing his anger at his own parents. She did this by criticizing them and fuming at them for him. Larry then was left with the simpler job of coming to their defense. This pattern began at the time of the birth of their first child. Larry's parents, who were quite wealthy, were spending the year in Paris and did not acknowledge their new granddaughter with enthusiasm or show interest in seeing her. Sandra reacted with outrage, declaring to Larry that they were cold and selfish people who thought only of themselves. Years later, she still spoke heatedly about their neglectful attitude, although always to Larry and never to his parents. What did Larry do? He made excuses for his parents and found logical reasons for their behavior, which only made Sandra angrier. It was another circular dance in which the behavior of each provoked the other into doing more of the same. The more Sandra criticized her in-laws to Larry, the more Larry came to their defense. The more Larry came to their defense, the more openly critical Sandra became. Deep down, of course, Larry was considerably more affected than Sandra by his parents' behavior. They were, after all, his parents, and he was their son. But because of Sandra's readiness to do the feeling work for him, Larry was in touch only with his loyalty to his parents, who were under his wife's attack. Sandra's focus on Larry's behavior with his parents, as opposed to her own relationship with her in-laws, complicated the problem and the solution. In fact, Sandra's focus on her husband obscured her own need to change matters. Larry's parents, who traveled a great deal, visited once a year. These visits were initiated by Larry's father, who would write a letter informing the couple when they would arrive and for how long they would stay. Being told rather than asked annoyed Sandra no end. She then put pressure on Larry to confront his parents regarding this matter, and he would refuse. In the face of Sandra's anger and criticisms, Larry predictably sided with them, putting forth logical arguments as to why his parents needed to schedule visits as they did. Sandra felt helpless, and for good reason. First, she was trying to make Larry do something, and it wasn't working. Second, she was doing the feeling work for him. Down the road a bit, Sandra changed both of these patterns. At some point, Sandra recognized that if the behavior of Larry's parents upset her, it was her job to deal with this herself. So she did. In a letter that was neither attacking nor blaming, Sandra explained to her in-laws that it was important to her to be consulted in arranging a mutually agreeable time for their visits. She stated her position warmly, but with clarity and directness, and she did not back down in the face of their initial defensiveness. Much to her surprise, her long pent-up anger at her in-laws began to dissipate as she became more confident that she could speak effectively to issues that were not to her liking. Also to her surprise, Larry's parents, in the end, responded warmly and affirmatively, thanking Sandra for her straightforwardness. This was the first step in Sandra's taking care of her own business with her in-laws, and in the process opening up a more direct person-to-person relationship with each of them. Larry, threatened by the new assertiveness that his wife was expressing, initially protested the very idea that she would write such a letter. In his typical style, he presented her with a dozen intellectual arguments to back his disapproval. Sandra, however, was clear in her resolve to change things, and resisted fighting back, since her experience had taught her that such arguments led nowhere. Instead, she explained to Larry that although she appreciated his point of view, she needed to make her own decisions about how, when, and if she would deal with issues that were important to her. When Larry observed that Sandra was continuing to address issues directly with his parents without criticizing or attacking them, a predictable next step occurred. His own unresolved issues with his mother and father surfaced full force. Sandra was no longer complaining to Larry about his parents, but managing her own business with them. In response to this, Larry began to feel an internal pressure to take care of his own. When a woman vents her anger ineffectively, like Sandra complaining to Larry about his parents, which surely wasn't going to change anything, or expresses it in an over-emotional style, she does not threaten her man. If anything, she helps him to maintain his masculine cool, while she herself is perceived as infantile or irrational. When a woman clarifies the issues and uses her anger to move toward something new and different, then change occurs. If she stops over-functioning for others and starts acting for herself, her under-functioning man is likely to acknowledge and deal with his own anxieties. The Blaming Game. Sandra and Larry had expended enormous amounts of energy blaming each other for their endless fights. Like many of us, their method of attributing blame was to look for the one who started it. The search for a beginning of a sequence is a common blaming game in couples. Consider, for example, the interaction between a nagging wife and a distant, withdrawing husband. The more he withdraws, the more she nags, and the more she nags, the more he withdraws, and so on. So, who is to blame? "I know," says one observer of this sequence. "She is to blame. First, she nags him and gets on his case for all kinds of things, and then the poor guy withdraws." "No," says a second observer, "you have it all wrong. He is. First, he buries himself in his work and ignores his family, and then his wife goes after him." This is the who started it game. The search for a beginning of a sequence, where the aim is to proclaim which person is to blame for the behavior of both. But we know that this interaction is really a circular dance, in which the behavior of one partner maintains and provokes the behavior of the other. The circular dance has no beginning and no end. In the final analysis, it matters little who started it. The question of greater significance is, how do we break out of it? A good way to make this break is to recognize the part we play in maintaining and provoking the other person's behavior. Even if we are convinced that the other person is 97% to blame, we are still in control of changing our own 3%. So the central question becomes, how can I change my steps in the circular dance? This is not to say that we don't have good reason to be furious with the other person, nor is it to say that our current sex roles and gender arrangements, which breed these sorts of dances, are not at fault. They are. Rather, it is simply to say that we don't have the power to change another person who does not want to change, and our attempts to do so may actually protect him or her from change. This is the paradox of the circular dances in which we all participate. Emotional pursuer, emotional distancer, a very old dance. Emotional pursuers are persons who reduce their anxiety by sharing feelings and seeking close emotional contact. Emotional distancers are persons who reduce their anxiety by intellectualizing and withdrawing. As with Sandra and Larry, it is most often the woman who is the emotional pursuer and the man who is the emotional distancer. When the waters are calm, the pursuer and the distancer may seem like the perfect complementary couple. She is spontaneous, lively, and emotionally responsive, He is reserved, calm, and logical. When the waters are rough, however, each exaggerates his or her own style, and that's where the trouble begins. What happens when the inevitable stresses of life hit this couple? It may be an illness, a child in difficulty, a financial worry, or a possible career move. No matter what the content of the problem, these two styles of responding suddenly seem at odds. She reacts quickly, seeking direct contact and refuge in togetherness. She shares her feelings and wants him to do the same. He reacts very logically and rationally in a manner that is not acceptable to her. So she pursues harder, wanting to know more of what he is thinking and feeling, and he distances further. The more he distances, the more she pursues, and the more she pursues, the more he distances. She accuses him of being cold, unresponsive, and inhuman. He accuses her of being pushy, hysterical, and controlling. What is the common outcome of this classic scenario? After this escalating dance of pursuit and withdrawal proceeds for some time, the woman goes into what therapists call reactive distance. Feeling rejected and fed up, she at last proceeds to go about her own business. The man now has even more space than he is comfortable with, and in time he moves closer to her in the hope of making contact, but is too late. "Where were you when I needed you?" she says angrily. At this point, distancer and pursuer might even reverse their roles for a while. Emotional pursuers protect emotional distancers. By doing the work of expressing the neediness, clinginess, and wish for closeness for both partners, pursuers make it possible for distancers to avoid confronting their own dependency, wishes, and insecurities. As long as one person is pursuing, the other has the luxury of experiencing a cool independence and a need for space. It's hardly surprising, considering her upbringing, that the woman is usually, though by no means always, the pursuer. It is another example of doing the feeling work for men. When a pursuer learns to back off and put her energies into her own life, especially if she can do this with dignity and without hostility, the distancer is more likely to recognize his own needs for contact and closeness and begin to pursue. But beware, this is no easy task. Most women who are emotional pursuers go off into a cold or angry, reactive distance, which only temporarily reverses the pursuit cycle or has little effect at all. Breaking the pursuit cycle. Sandra and Larry were caught in an escalating cycle of pursuit and distance for many years prior to their seeking help. Since the birth of their first child, Larry was decreasing his emotional involvement with Sandra as he increased the energy he put into work and hobbies. Sandra alternated between active pursuit, angry criticism, and a cold, bitter withdrawal. Sadly, but predictably, their relationship had gone from bad to worse. On one particular Friday night, almost a year following our first meeting, Sandra broke the pursuit cycle. It was her increased sense of personal responsibility to provide for her own needs, as well as her growing awareness that she could not change her husband, that allowed her to do something new and different. And something new and different is exactly what Sandra did. This Friday evening began like all others. The children were in bed, and Larry was shuffling through his briefcase, about to pull out a couple hours' work. Sandra came and sat down next to him on the couch. Larry bristled, expecting the usual attack, but it did not come. Instead, Sandra began to speak warmly and with assurance. "Larry, I feel like I owe you an apology. I've been on your back for a long time. I realize that I've been wanting you to provide me with something that really I need to provide for myself. Perhaps part of the problem is that you have family and work, and I have only you and the kids. It's my problem, and I recognize that I need to do something about it." "Oh," muttered Larry with a somewhat unsettled look on his face. He seemed at an uncharacteristic loss for words. Well, that's nice. The very next night, Sandra asked Larry if he would mind putting the children to bed himself on Tuesday and Friday, because she was planning to go out. Larry protested that he had too much work. Instead of arguing, Sandra called the sitter to come in and help on those evenings. On Tuesday night, Sandra joined a yoga class that met weekly. On Friday night, she went to the movies with a friend and then out for a glass of wine. She did not pursue Larry in any way, nor did she distance from him or withdraw coldly. If anything, she was warmer to him than usual, although clearly directing much of her energy toward her own interests and scheduling. After 3 weeks of this, Larry, who had wanted nothing more than to be left alone, began to get nervous. Much to his surprise, he became quite uncomfortable when his wife's bleep was off his radar screen. At first, he tried to provoke her into fighting by attempting to control what she could or could not do with her evenings. Without retaliating, Sandra explained to Larry that she was a social person with social needs, and that she was no longer able to neglect this important part of her life. Her warm firmness on this issue communicated clearly to Larry that she was acting for herself and not against him. Next, Larry started to pursue her. Instead of bringing his work home, he suggested they use the sitter to go out together, something they almost never did on a weeknight. As Larry increasingly began to experience and express his own dependency and insecurity, a funny thing happened. Sandra, for the first time, got in touch with her own wish to be left alone. For a while, they simply reversed their roles as pursuer and distancer, until, finally, they got things in balance. And when that occurred, Sandra and Larry were able to recognize that each of them harbored strong dependency wishes, as well as a wish to flee when things became too close. Why was it Sandra who finally took the initiative in breaking the circular dance? Sandra was in greater emotional pain than Larry, and her role as the pursuer in the relationship placed her in a more emotionally vulnerable position. When she became convinced that her old ways simply were not working for her, she found the motivation to move differently. Why did she have to take the responsibility to make the change? Simply because no one else was going to do it for her. Breaking the pursuit cycle did not in itself lead to emotional closeness for Sandra and Larry. There were important barriers to intimacy that the two of them were left to struggle with. However, Sandra and Larry could work more successfully on their relationship once they recognized that they shared a common problem. Both of them wished for closeness and also feared it. Before Sandra broke the pursuit cycle, Larry had the false but comforting fantasy that all of the neediness and wish for closeness was in Sandra. Likewise, Sandra imagined that all of the avoidance of and flight from intimacy was in Larry. When a pursuer stops pursuing and begins to put her energy back into her own life, without distancing or expressing anger at the other person, the circular dance has been broken. Because this may smack of the old hard-to-get tactics that women have been taught to play, it may sound inauthentic or manipulative. But continuing the old dance of pursuit or cold withdrawal is not more honest.